It's season two of the Carson McCullough Center's weekly We of Me. This is the second of three episodes based on our interview with National Book Award finalist Jen Shapland.
This segment of the interview has been edited for time and content.
This makes me think of another thing. You know, it's like straight washing instead of whitewashing. It's like straight washing, right? And that, as you said, the biographers want to control the narrative, or at least they, for whatever reason, they come up with their version of the narrative. Maybe they're not even trying, as you said, it's not even as sinister as trying to hide something. It's just the way they see it, which ends up being sort of straight washing and saying that Reeves was the love of her life and all of these other attractions to women or affairs with women or relationships with women were just sort of side notes, whatever you want to call it. Do you think that maybe the first person to try to straight wash the narrative was Carson herself?
That's a great question. I mean, one of the things that I think I found inspiring when reading, especially some of the materials that are in Carson's own words, was just how open she was, in particular, you know, about some of the difficulty with Reeves, but then also about her relationships with women and her love for women. Anne Marie and Dr. Mercer, but then also a number of other women who appear kind of over the years in her letters. Some of them kind of just mentioned haphazardly and kind of offhand. But she's not hiding, at least in her friendships and you know, with her relationship with her mother and her sister. She's not hiding who she is. She's not hiding her relationships with women at all. At the same time, you know, I do think that she was living in a time when sort of the more public persona, the more public narrative that circulated about her necessarily didn't include these relationships. So I don't know. I don't know if I would say that Carson is the first person to sort of straight wash herself, but I do think that she struggled and didn't really have a clear way of articulating her identity for most of her life. And certainly she wasn't kind of like someone who was out and sort of labeled in a way that someone might be today. A lot of that, I think, has a lot to do with the time period, and especially with, you know, by the end of her life, the 50s, the kind of the Lavender Scare and things that were going on where queer people were being sort of actively persecuted in ways that maybe they hadn't been during kind of the 40s, during the war years. But yeah, you know, I keep thinking, and I wish I had asked Carlos this. I don't know if you know the answer, but I remember reading that when she was writing Illumination and Night Glare, she wanted to include the letters with Reeves, but she also wanted to include the letters with Anne Marie. She had these kind of like two sections of letters that she wanted to be in the book. But in Carlos's book, only Reeves' letters appear. And I had meant to ask him why it was that Anne Marie's weren't there. So, but that suggests to me that for Carson, you know, these were two relationships or two companionships, two exchanges that were deeply important to her identity, to who she thought she was.
Well, that in fact was my next question for you. She put in the manuscript, insert war letters here. In your book, I think, and I don't want to misspeak here, but I think you say to you that these are letters in which clearly Reeves is trying to get back with Carson. He's like, you know, this is the point. He's trying to edge his way back into that relationship, and that Carson, maybe out of a sense of duty, responds to him. And then maybe also later out of a sense of anxiety about his safety, that she is, you know, really concerned. And I mean, we've read some of the letters on the podcast, and they're very touching, you know, in both directions. I mean, I think Carlos mentioned this when I interviewed him for the podcast, that Reeves's letters about the battle scenes, and those are some of the most vivid accounts of the war that I've ever read. I mean, to me, that's the best writing he ever did, you know. It's the only writing that anybody's ever seen, besides, you know, these letters are. But also Carson's letters to him, I don't know, maybe this is just my own reading. I feel like maybe they are a little more loving than your reading of them is. But I think that you feel like it's mostly her anxiety about his safety. But I guess my main question is, why do you think that she wanted to have the letters in her autobiography, the war letters?
That's a good question. I mean, it certainly shows kind of a lot of what she's going through while he's at war. And it certainly shows, yeah, the depth of her investment in him, investment in their relationship. I mean, I don't think I have an answer to that. And I don't think that I am the most reliable source to, you know, interpret the letters, you know, any more than anyone else, because clearly, you know, in my book, I'm focused on sort of this evolution that gets her to her relationship with Mary and to kind of some of the realizations that she has in her therapy and in those transcripts. So I kind of see her kind of slowly extricating herself from this relationship. But at the same time, you know, for her to lose Reeves in the war would be to lose a huge component of her identity and would be to lose kind of this possibility of their love and their connection that, you know, she had believed in for so many years. So that's threatening, you know, not just the loss of Reeves, but also a huge loss to herself. Mm-hmm. And I definitely see that kind of in the fear and in the anxiety that comes through in the letters. But there's also another kind of historical component of this that I mention in the book, which is that a huge number of people got married before, during, and right after the war. I think that something about that global, I don't know, that global terror, right? Yeah. That fear, that kind of existential fear that the war brought up for people, it led to a lot of marriages. It led to a lot of people kind of making really dramatic commitments to one another. And I think that's an interesting kind of sociological phenomenon that we can examine. And so Carson's remarriage to Reeves kind of comes at that moment, which I think, you know, it's just interesting to kind of have that larger context in play as well.
It does seem to me that she's really proud of him. At least that she's proud of what he's done. And, you know, it allowed him to sort of get his life back together, really, because he was a mess before that. But you write in the book, quote, "Now I think of sexuality and identity, gender too, as a process of trial and error. You need a narrative with room for messiness, one that can accommodate veering toward extremes," end quote. What do you mean by veering toward extremes?
Well, I think in my own life, that looks like, you know, kind of at the time when I'm finding those letters between Carson and Anne Marie in this closeted relationship. I was also pursued by a male professor in my department. And so I kind of did this 180 and was suddenly in a relationship with a man and, you know, with a very fraught power dynamic. And so to me, like, that's a moment of messiness in my own story. That's a moment of veering toward extremes. And in the process of trying to figure out who I am, almost trying to bounce my identity off of these different relationships, these different situations, when I talk to other queer people, I never find someone who figured out who they were early on and then acted accordingly for the rest of their lives. That's really very rarely the case. Instead, it's kind of this back and forth, this, you know, trying to decide, you know, who do I want to be in relationship with and how does that reflect back on me, back on who I am? I was really kind of amazed while I was on the book tour for this book last February, before everything shut down for COVID. I went to 13 cities, a number of them in the South, and Carson McCullers fans came out of the woodwork because, you know, everyone who is a Carson McCullers fan is pretty deeply invested in her. And the number of people who came up to me and who said, you know, I read Carson McCullers when I was a teenager or when I was in high school. I think she was taught in high school a lot more in the past. And her work really resonated with me and meant so much to me at the time. And then these people would have heard me speak, you know, they hadn't read my book, but they'd heard me speak. And then they said, you know, I came out in my 40s. I didn't know for most of my life that I was gay, but I kind of finally figured it out. And a lot of these people would have these stories, you know, very similar to my experience, or in a way similar to Carson's experience, the way I understand it. I just found it so, so interesting that it was like, It was one messy narrative after another, often with some kind of relationship to Carson McCullers' work at an early age, kind of, you know, somehow being folded into that. The same thing happened when I talked to Natalie Goldberg, who is a writer. She wrote the book Writing Down the Bones, which a lot of creative nonfiction writers will be familiar with. She lives in Santa Fe, and I've become friends with her, but she, you know, she read Ballad of the Sad Cafe. She would actually be a great person to have on this podcast. She read Ballad of the Sad Cafe when she was in high school, and it changed her life. It made her want to be a writer. And then, you know, when she was, I think, in her 50s was when she actually came out as a lesbian. And she'd never kind of put those two things together, like set them side by side. Was there something about Amelia and the way I related to this character in this novel, and my own struggle with identity that kind of went on and on and on. But yeah, messiness seems to be something that a lot of queer people have in common. It's certainly not uncommon for a queer person to have been married to someone of the opposite sex, even for most of their life, and not kind of really come to terms with their identity.
Do you think that stems partly from the imprecision of the terms, or the other way around, that the imprecision of the terms stems from the messiness? You know, because when I read McCullers as a young person, I felt that one of the things that she had depicted in her book, and the first book I read was The Heart is the Lonely Hunter, but then I read, you know, pretty much all of them at one go, was that the terms we have for human sexuality are just not precise. And that, you know, they're like these labels, but no label quite fits, you know, that it's not a perfect. And I'm also, you know, I asked Sarah Shulman when she was on here, she said, you've probably read her article that she published in The New Yorker back in 2016, I think it was, where she said that if Carson McCullers were living now, she would self-identify as a transgender man. And I just happened to see a copy of a magazine, a local arts and culture magazine called Columbus in the Valley, that someone gave me because it was Carlos Duz's sort of announcing the establishment of the Carson McCullers Center and writing this article for this local, you know, culture magazine. And he says, you know, talking about Carson McCullers' life and her marriage to Reeves, he says they were both bisexual. I thought this is interesting, right? I think it's clear in your book, you want to say Carson McCullers is lesbian, and Sarah Shulman says she would be a transgender man, and Carlos too said, well, she's bisexual. I mean, do you think imprecision of terms is part of the problem here, or do you think it's just people see it differently? Or I asked Sarah Shulman this question. She goes, well, in a sense, they're the same thing. And I was like, really? Okay. I don't know. What do you think?
I think it's a good question. I think it's one of the reasons why I tend to opt for the word queer, especially when talking about Carson, because, you know, even if we can't agree or we can't find a label that feels satisfying, and labels are, you know, by necessity, these kind of clunky, incomplete things that don't really necessarily fit anyone particularly well. If we identify her as queer, we're at least being specific enough to say, to acknowledge the fact of her relationships with women, which is, you know, one of the things I'm at pains to do in this book, is to really kind of, you know, give these relationships some space and really suggest that they were significant and deeply important and formative to Carson McCullers. But I think that queer is also a good word in this instance. I mean, it's a word that's been sort of reappropriated first by academics and theorists to approach and understand sexuality. I think it's a way of acknowledging some of the messiness we were just talking about, because I'm sure that it would make someone uncomfortable to hear me say, let's say, that Carson really loved Reese, but also she was a lesbian. Like, that doesn't really make sense, right, to most people. Queer is a word that resurfaces in every one of Carson's books. She loves that word. She uses it over and over. And at the time of her writing, you know, it has a different meaning and a different valence. It's much more of a derogatory term that's being used to describe homosexual people, but it also is a word that just means kind of weird and out of place. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think she makes a lot of those different valences of that word. Who knows, you know, to what extent she's aware that she's doing it, but I do take note of it. I mean, it appears like 10 times in the first few pages of The Member of the Wedding. So I think, you know, that's the label that I would feel most comfortable with. At the same time, in my book, I'm struggling with my own identity and with my own, you know, understanding of labels and what labels fit me. which is, you know, a vulnerable thing to do on the page. And what I arrive at, or where I sort of arrive with that, is that I want to take the word lesbian, which is the word that's so absent from these biographies of Carson McCullers. It's like a word that no one really wants to touch. But it is a word that comes up in her therapy sessions numerous times. And I want to take that kind of word that we are a little bit afraid of, or that we want to sort of distance ourselves from, distance Carson McCullers from, and think about how could we make this word more capacious. And so I have a sort of like outrageous moment in the book where I say, maybe anyone who sees a part of himself as a woman and loved another woman could be seen as a lesbian. You know, maybe we could just expand what that word means a little bit. And I think in that case, then Carson fits under that umbrella. But I do think it's so interesting how easy it is for the research that a person has done into Carson's life to sort of, you know, color the way that they understand her. So yeah, Carlos would say bisexual, and Sarah Schulman would say a trans man. My research and the reading that I did of some of these materials really emphasizes her love for women. So that's where sort of my perspective comes in.
You say, you relate that when you read Carson's therapy transcripts, you quote, see the only story she ever wrote, a lonely misfit wrestles with her hidden self, unable to articulate her own longings, end quote. When I read Carson McCullers' work, one of the things that stands out is the innate human desire to connect with other people. Mm-hmm. You know, the drive to connect, to feel yourself, as Carson says in one interview, a part of life. Can we reconcile those two things? I mean, are they just two sides of the same coin, would you say?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think a lonely misfit who's kind of unable to articulate her own longings, and the longing is to connect, right? The longing is to find communion and to feel like you belong, to feel like you're no longer an unjoined person, you know, as she says at the beginning of Member of the Wedding. I think that one of the things that's so amazing about Carson's fiction and about revisiting it is the way that she makes room for human connection, even when, you know, she's wrestling with these feelings of loneliness, these feelings of being an outsider. You know, still there are these moments where her characters are able to connect. They're able to connect across kind of vast oceans of difference, whether that's differences of class or race or sexuality or ability. I think that's what a lot of readers today really tend to remark upon in her fiction, is that she's always, you know, bringing people together who maybe don't think they have anything in common or any grounds to connect, and finding ways to kind of forge that connection. And so, yeah, I do think those are two sides of the same coin.
Select your sorrows if you can. Edit your ironies. Even grieve with guile. Adjust to a world divided, which demands your candid senses stoop to labyrinthine wiles. What natural alchemy lends to the scrubby grocery boy with dirty hair the luster of Apollo, or golden Hyacinth's fabled stare? If you must cross the April park, be brisk. Avoid the cadence of the evening, eyes from afar, lest you be held as a security risk. Solicit only the evening star. The world that jibes your tenderness jails your lust. Bewildered by the paradox of all your musts, turning from horizon to horizon, noonday to dusk, it may be only you can understand. On a mild sea afternoon of blue and gold, when the sky is the mild blue of a Chinese bowl, the bones of heart crane sailors and the drugstore man beat on the ocean's floor the same saraband. This is another poem. There was a time when stone was stone, and the face on the street was a finished face. Between the thing, myself, and God alone, there was an instant symmetry. Now all is changed. This trinity is twisted. Stone is not stone, and faces like the fractioned characters in dreams are incomplete. Until in the child's unfinished face, I recognize your exiled eyes. The soldier climbs the evening stair, leaving your shadow. Tonight, this torn room sleeps beneath the starlight bent by you. This is another poem. When we are lost, what image tells? Nothing resembles nothing. Yet nothing is not blank. It is configured hell. Of notice clocks on winter afternoons, malignant stars demanding furniture, all unrelated and with air between. The terror, is it of space, of time, or the joint trickery of both conceptions? To the lost, transfixed among the self-inflicted ruins, all that is non-air, if this indeed is not deception, is agony immobilized. While time, the endless idiot, runs screaming round the world.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Carson McCullough Center's weekly We of Me. If you enjoyed this episode, you can find more at mccullerscenter.org or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. This podcast was brought to you by Columbus State University's Carson McCullough Center for Writers and Musicians and by Columbus State University's recording studio. The music you heard during the intro and outro was written by Lilia Uge in honor of Carson McCullough's 100th birthday on February 19th, 2017. I'm Nick Williams, technical director for these podcasts, and I hope you have a great day. The reading you heard is from the 1958 MGM Records recording E3619 ARC, Carson McCullough's Reads from the Member of the Wedding and Other Works.